And welcome to Say What, where we talk about the things that make us say, Say What. I'm Marianne.
And I'm Cassie.
And today we're interviewing Rick Saar about the G12 resolution for conference this year.
It's great to have you here.
Well, it's great to be online here on the other side of the earth.
So we have just fun questions first. Do you think that you would survive a zombie apocalypse?
Yes, what I would do is I would dress up as a zombie, and so they wouldn't know that I was one of the non-zombies, so I could just integrate myself, and I'd survive that quite easily, I think.
You just don't have much of an appetite for brains, that's all.
I would look like a zombie, and I would walk around like a zombie. I'd be fine. People sometimes think I do that anyway.
So what part of a driver's test do you think you would most likely fail or at least do poorly in?
Well, when I'm driving and I'm listening to music, I drum on the steering wheel. And my wife sometimes says, honey, stop drumming because you've got to hold onto the steering wheel. So I might drive I might fail the did not hang on to driving with steering wheel test. But otherwise, I'd be fine, I think. Mind you, we're driving on this side of the world. We drive on the left-hand side of the road, so you'd worry about me, I think, being on the wrong side of the road.
That's just like kind of what I was thinking about personally. Do you ever talk to inanimate objects?
No, but I used to talk to my dog a lot, even though he didn't answer back. He'd just look at me and think that was pretty cool. So not inanimate, but certainly animate, but not necessarily human.
Yeah. He's probably just thinking you're nuts or something. That's it.
I think anyone who talks to an inanimate object would be nuts, yes.
A little
I
bit
see.
Nuts. It's not like talking to, more like shouting at or apologizing to or trying to forcefully convince this thing to work.
Oh, I see. Yes, I have done that. I have cursed my laptop. That's true. Yes.
So, if you dream, what is the weirdest dream you've ever had?
Well, the weirdest dream I ever had, this actually was quite a profound dream. I had a dream some years ago where I had run across myself as a little kid, 6 or 7 years old. And that was really profound because I said to the kid, you know, here's what you can expect in your life. And he sort of said, I don't care. And he ran away. I thought that was listen to me. But there I was. There I was as a little kid. And I was an old man talking to a little kid who was me. That was really weird and profound at the same time.
Wow. Just the fact that he just like kind of walked away like he didn't care. I mean, personally, I would care. I would totally care.
Yeah.
I mean, I would care, but I can't say for 100% that I would listen.
True. That's very true.
So, do you have a favorite thing about living in Australia? If so, what is it?
Look, Australia is a lovely country. It's very modern. It's got beautiful climate. It's got miles and thousands of miles of beaches. It's got clean air and a very good democratic government. We're well governed and we're very safe and very well educated. It really is one of the glorious parts of the world to live. And I have visited, wait for it, I think I added them up the other day, 75 or 76 countries. And so I've had a good look around. And I can't, another country I'd rather live in.
Wow. Personally, it's kind of on our bucket list to visit.
You're most welcome.
What would be the top three places you would tell someone to visit who wants to tour your home country?
Well, most people who come to Australia go and see the Sydney Harbour Bridge and the Opera House. They go to the middle of the country to see Uluru, the big rock. They probably go to the Barrier Reef, the largest coral reef in the world, or they go to Tasmania to see the Tasmanian devils and do some fishing. But I think they should come to Adelaide. It's where I live. Adelaide is a gorgeous city of 1 million people on the side of the ocean. And I'm very proud of the way in which our city functions. It's a lovely city. And that would be the first person, the first thing I'd recommend to come to Adelaide. And come with us down to the beach. We can sit on the beach with no one else and just watch the
I
waves wash by.
love beaches. I mean, we're kind of biased living in Pensacola. We've got white sand beaches, so
I have been to, I've been to Pensacola.
you have.
Yeah. I had a Christmas 1996 in Pensacola, Florida. There you go.
I think probably my favorite thing about living down south in Florida is we don't get snow. I mean, we got snow last week, but that was insanely weird.
It was insanely
I
weird.
hate the cold. So you're a retired professor. What were you a professor of and where?
I was a professor of law and criminology, and I have done that here in Adelaide for the last 35 years. But I did have a year at Graceland teaching as part of their program in social sciences, teaching law and criminology. And I also had a year in Sweden where I taught at a university up north near the Arctic Circle, and that was with the family. And over the years, I've taught in various little programs around Australia. So I've been doing this for a long time.
I have two questions. What's criminology?
That's the first question. What's the second one? Are they the related questions?
No. Why the Arctic Circle?
Let me come. They're not related questions. Criminology is the study of crime, who commits it, why they commit it, how they commit it, and what police, courts, corrections can do about stopping it. So that's the gist of it. Now, criminology involves four different disciplines. You have the discipline of sociology, looking at the way in which society is constructed that might give rise to crime, psychology, which is when people's mind goes a little bit more criminal. The lawyers, which is me basically, where you look at the way in which laws can be framed in order to reduce crime, and typically political science to see the way in which politicians and governments try to address the whole issue of criminality. So, criminology is something that cuts across a number of disciplines. Why the Arctic Circle? Because back some 20 years ago, when our kids were about your age, a little bit younger, I was invited to go to teach at Umeå University, which is a university up near the Arctic Circle, a Swedish university. And so it was very, very dark in the winter and very, very light in the summer. I'd be guessing in terms of latitude, it would be kind of like Northern Ontario. And I did, in fact, I
Wow.
spent 2 years in Canada too, studying at the University of Toronto. So I've had a good look at snow over all these years. You don't get any snow here where I live. But I do enjoy it when I go and visit to Iowa and Canada and Sweden.
That's really cool. I personally would never go that far north.
I might, but I don't know if I would stay there for that long. So we read in your bio that your children are also into law. Is this a family interest that's been there for past generations? And what are your family conversations at dinner like?
Well, they don't happen very often these days because they both moved out of home. But in fact, both of them were here last night for dinner. So that was interesting. They both have partners. They both have other homes. So I'm kind of what's called an empty nester now. My wife has a degree in psychology and I have this degree in law. And both the kids went off and did things that were not law. One went off and did communications. One went off and did psychology. And then a couple of years later, they came back and said, "Dad, think we want to be lawyers." So I was a bit surprised and I was very pleased. But yes, there's something about the thinking process of law which I think must have come through my genes.
So you've also been a member of the High Council since 2013. What is the High Council and what are your responsibilities?
It's called the Standing High Council, which makes for a few jokes around our family. Like my wife would say, "Honey, are you going to watch a Zoom of the Standing High Council, or do you want to sit down?" That's a kind of a standing. The Standing High Council is a group of, well, 12 people until about, oh, I don't know, 25 years ago. It was all men, and they're all high priests in the church who then provided in a lay ministry style. In other words, you really are not an employee of the church, but the first presidency uses the Standing High Council as a kind of a sounding board. So they want to talk about some things that might be changing politically or changing theologically. They'll sound it out with the Standing High Council. We meet something like four times a year. We used to meet in Independence. Then, of course, Zoom made that a lot easier. And typically we meet during conference as well. I'm stepping off the Standing High Council. There's coming in conference in 2025, so it'll be a 12 or 13 years stint, which I think is about right. And I'll be replaced by, I think there are three people stepping off and three people stepping in. So it revolves, but essentially it provides a good background for the first presidency to run ideas past and to get some feedback.
Cool. So, basically, very much the council part of a council. Yeah, that was
Well, that's
circular.
right. We provide counsel, as in counsel, by being a council, counsil. But it's not the same as the apostles. The 12 apostles are all employees. The 12 of us in the Standing High Council are non-employees. But we have to be high priests. That's part of the requirement. And it used to be, I should say, going back some 30 years, the Standing High Council used to come up with kind of dictates, a statement on women in the priesthood, a statement on homosexuality, a statement on baptism. And now the Standing High Council doesn't do that anymore. We simply provide background information and a talking point for the first presidency.
I think I read one of those the other day. It was actually on abortion, but I'm not getting into that right now. So you study law, amongst other things, in school. How has that influenced your ministry?
I love that question because there is an element of the way in which lawyers think, which I think does enhance, if not so much personal ministry, certainly administrative ministry. I remember being at law school, and it's a 4-year program here, and halfway through my 3rd year, I remember walking out of a class, walking back to my office or back to my desk, and thinking, I now know what I'm doing. I can now think like a lawyer. And thinking like a lawyer is pretty useful in terms of church ministry insofar you weigh things up, you look at things on one hand, on the other hand, you look at the personal aspects of it, you look at the administrative aspects of it, you look at the cost aspects of it, and then you kind of reach out with an idea to test the waters. And every now and again, you need to go to a judge. Of course, in the law, you go to a judge who's actually a judge. In the church, you tend to go to a mission center council or a world conference to try and get some sense of whether or not what you've come up with is going to be put into law. The legal aspect of what I do in the church, I think, is a valuable aspect in bringing about looking at the ways in which things are done, how best they're done, how they appeal to as many people as possible, and how they can operate effectively going forward. So I rather like the idea of being a lawyer within the church, yes.
We read that you attended Graceland University or college at that time. What was your Graceland experience like?
I love Graceland. I didn't finish a degree there. I was only there for 1 year because I was between law school and going to grade school in Canada. But Graceland College, as it was then, was a turning point in my life. It gave me a magnificent set of friends whom I still keep in touch with. And was one of the high points of my spiritual life as well.
You mentioned that Graceland was a high point in your spiritual life. Could you elaborate on that for us a little bit?
Well, I can assure you that back in the 1970s, Graceland had a very strong connection with the church. It still has a connection with the church, but back in my days, there were 1,200 students in campus, and 85% of them were affiliated with the church. Now there's about 2/3 of that number, and only about maybe 15 or 20% of students are actually affiliated with the church. So there's a very strong church presence, and we had strong leadership. Everett Graffio at the time was the campus minister. That's before he went on to become an apostle and then later presiding evangelist. And it was just a terrific environment. We had a chaplain in our house. We had lots of opportunities to be involved in spiritual activities. I really enjoyed it.
So, what made you want to study criminology, and how have that field and law shaped who you are?
Well, in fact, I did criminology as an undergraduate subject in law school, and then I went to Graceland, did some sociology as a senior. That's when I was 22 years old, and then I went on to grad school in Canada, where I had a scholarship to study a master's in criminology. It was just something I thought I had an interest in. I had been a criminal and wanted to be a criminal lawyer, and I thought I could also do some studies in policing, which I've continued to do. I just like the idea of making sure that our societies are safe and that the human condition can be so shaped that we don't have to resolve issues non-peacefully. So I suppose being at a peace church, the idea was there that criminology was one way, if we could reduce crime, that we can become a far more peaceful society.
So, one of your favorite hobbies is writing. What kinds of things do you like to write?
Well, funny you should say that because I do write a lot. I do a lot of book reviews. I'm president of the Friends of the State Library here. And over the years, I think I don't know, written maybe 100 formal book reviews of books that I've read. But in fact, I did produce my own memoir. In fact, I'll wave the little bookmark here. I did a book called Life Actually about back in 19, sorry, 2021, where I reflected upon my life in 80,000 words. So I shouldn't say I like writing about myself. I like writing about things that have influenced me and influenced other people about making our society a better place. So that's what I write. I write solid pieces about good things and how we could better our lives by focusing on those good things.
Writing is an interesting way to process thoughts.
Yeah, I think you're right. When you ever write things, you're in a far better position to know what it is you are thinking about. You have committed yourself to putting something in writing, then you've thought about it, and it has to be logical. Yes, I like that.
So, Resolution G12 is asking the church to support policies that will help reduce gun violence, with special interest in non-proliferation or reducing spread. Is that correct?
Now, that's a good summary. And in fact, I want to make it abundantly clear that this resolution is designed to get members of the church to essentially try and reduce the number of firearms in communities. It's just a very sad thing that across many nations, as people get fearful, they tend to go out and buy more firearms. And I'm suggesting reduction in supply of firearms is one of the best ways of reducing gun violence.
I definitely agree with that. Honestly, fear is the reason for violence, and violence creates fear, which is a very cruel circle there. So you wrote in your resolution that in Australia there are policies in place to regulate and monitor the availability of firearms. Would you please say more about those policies?
Well, let me tell you something about the world first and then come back to Australia. Again, it looks on its face that when I take this G12 to conference, that somehow or other I'm being critical of the United States, particularly notwithstanding that we're a world church. But yes, I am being critical of the United States. Four of the five major gun manufacturers in the world are American countries, are American companies. And I should also mention two other quick facts that for every 100 Americans, we're talking about North, not North Americans, but United States citizens, for every 100 of those, there are 120 guns. Now, that is twice the number of the next in line across the world. The next in line is Yemen with 50, and in Australia, it's 17. Let me just repeat that. For every 100 Americans, there are 120 guns. So we're talking more than 400 million guns. In Australia, for every 100 Australians, there are 17 guns. So there's a massive differential in that regard. Another quick one for you, which I put in the background statement with the resolution, is that the United States represents about 5% of the world's population, but has 40% of privately owned guns in the world. So 5% of the population of the world, 40% of privately owned firearms are in the United States. So anyone who says that I'm kind of picking on the United States, I think the answer is yes. And I'm saying you can do it a different way. I'm a bit sad about that because in some respects, I think America has now gone beyond the point of no return. Hence my addressing this particular issue to try and get Americans particularly to put guns to one side. But in Australia, we have every one of our guns is registered, and every person who owns a gun has to be licensed. It is a strong regulatory atmosphere. And to that extent, I think we have about, oh, I would be guessing, probably 1,000 Australians per year die as a result of guns, probably principally by suicide. In the United States in 2022, 48,000 people died by gunshot wound. Now, half of those were suicides, but that's a lot of people. That's almost as many as the number of American servicemen who lost their lives in Vietnam. So we're talking here about a massive loss of life as a result of firearms. And part of what I'm trying to do here in this resolution is to address that issue.
You sort of answered one of the questions that I was going to ask later. I was going to ask if you think that mandating licenses would slow the the gun violence. Can you hear me?
Now it says your bandwidth is low, but I can hear you now. There you go.
So I was going to ask later, but since you already touched on it, I might as well ask. Do you think that mandating licenses would slow gun violence in most nations, in every nation?
I'm simply making the point that in Australia, it has had the effect of keeping our guns well regulated and in the hands of those people who need them for example, farming or whatever. We don't need guns by way of trying to protect ourselves from others. And to the extent that a person who has a gun in Australia has to show a bona fide need for that gun and be licensed and have all of his or her guns registered. It has the effect of slowing down that proliferation of guns in private hands. And to the extent that that is probably now, I would say, impossible in the United States, I'm not going to say that we should be calling for all nations to regulate guns to the extent that if it's not possible, it's just simply not going to happen. I'm simply in this resolution trying to make the point again that Christians should be kind of having at the forefront of their mind that guns do not provide peaceful societies. If anything, they make societies far more violent.
Do you think that trying to get a gun license would be similar in length and safety to getting a driver's license?
The question is, should it be kind of an exercise in the same way that one person needs to get a license to drive a vehicle? In the same way that a vehicle can be very dangerous if used in the wrong hands. I think the analogy is correct. A gun can be very dangerous if used for all the wrong purposes. And so, if a person is to be licensed in Australia, they need to go through a mandatory training in the safe use of that firearm. All firearms at home, and typically that's only in farmers' hands, or if you're a law enforcement officer, you'll have to have your firearm kept away from the ammunition, etc. So, those sorts of regulatory requirements are here in Australia, and it has kept Australia very much as a gun-free society.
So, how would you envision the church advocating against gun violence, and how would we go about doing that in our communities?
It's designed to be a resolution for the entire church. And as you know, the church has a presence in probably 30 or 40 countries. So the idea would be that we would be advocating a greater stewardship of firearm ownership. And to the extent that nations are looking to regulate and license firearm owners and firearms, The church is making a statement here in applauding that particular position. Now, having said that, as I said before, the nation that is most at fault in relation to, if I can use that term, in relation to firearms is the nation that is actually hosting the World Conference in a very large manner. As I said, 120 firearms per every 100 American, and the next is Yemen at 50, and the next after that is Serbia at 30, and you've got to go a long way down to Australia at 17. So even though I'm making a statement, or the resolution is trying to make a statement, that all nations where the church is positioned should be making this a point of clarity and a point of concern, the major country that needs to be addressing this particular issue is the United States.
So how would a nation like America, whose laws or rights allow for gun ownership peacefully in united ways, accept such stipulations?
Well, that's right, and it's a change of mindset. And the mindset I want to change is the one that says we're far safer to have a firearm by the front door in case someone's going to come and, ransack our house, than not having a firearm. And all the evidence is contrary to that. All the evidence says that if you've got a firearm in your home, your chance of having a death in that home by mistake or by an angry argument that turns fatal, or by a child picking up a firearm and thinking it's quite safe. In those circumstances, you're far less safe having a firearm in your possession than not having a firearm. And so I'm trying to suggest that a stewardship of firearm ownership is a far better way to bring about a more peaceful society than suggesting we're all going to be like the sheriffs of old running through the frontier, bringing about peace in societies. It just doesn't work that way. In fact, it's a far greater threat, particularly for young women, at the hands of violent husbands. Rather than using their fists, the husband picks up a firearm and shoots his wife or partner, or indeed the partner, fearing being beaten up by the husband, picks up the firearm and shoots him. As I said, we have 48,000 people a year dying by gunshot in the United States. That's something that really should be making our heads shake and think about some ways of reducing that.
The resolution also asks the church to provide study materials for congregations. What do you hope that'll look like?
Well, that's right. The church has, as part of this resolution, as a kind of an action item, a question that we put in the resolution was, okay, it's one thing to talk about this. It's something else to actually have some facts and figures in front of us. So the idea would be that if the resolution passes, the Peace and Justice team, through me, would provide something fairly straightforward in relation to what we think people should know about the dangers of firearms. And one of the great dilemmas of this is that every time there's a school shooting or a mass shooting in the United States, and they seem to be happening on a weekly basis, people go out and buy firearms. Why do they go out and buy firearms? Because they think there's going to be some gun control. So it simply proliferates the problem. And that sort of mindset needs to be changed. And I believe if we have some materials presented for the church, we can bring about that change.
So how would you make those study materials like available to everybody?
Yeah, we'd provide something, put them on a website. That's the lovely thing about websites these days. You can provide information for the church very, very quickly. That's what we would do. I'd provide some very useful tools to have people really understand how the mindset of thinking you are safer with a firearm needs to be challenged.
How would you say that your life experience in law, criminology, and other similar things has affected the writing of this resolution?
Back in 1996, there was a mass shooting in Australia. It was completely out of the blue. It had never happened here on the same scale before, where a young man in Tasmania took a number of semi-automatic firearms to the idyllic part of Tasmania, and he started shooting people, and he shot 35 people dead. One of the church members was actually in the cafe where he started that. In fact, she was not hit, but the person next to her bled all over her, and so when she lay on the floor, he thought she was dead. That's how she survived that particular issue. So that actually spurred me on to bring the resolution to the church in 2000, which first called upon the church to call for a stewardship of firearm ownership. That's World Church Resolution 1270. And I have just always, at that point, realized that as a result of the way in which the government of Australia responded to that, which was to destroy hundreds of thousands of semi-automatic pump-action shotgun and automatic firearms that were available, it's now impossible to own a semi-automatic in Australia or a pump-action shotgun in Australia. They've now been completely banned. And that was a turning point in Australia's gun control process. We then licensed everyone, we then registered every firearm and put in place since 1997 this massive control of firearms. And the way in which Australia has now been virtually, well, actually completely mass shooting free in that last 30 years or so has been testament to the fact that that particular buyback scheme, which cost us hundreds of millions of dollars, I should say, because every person who handed a gun in got some money for that particular gun. But we've got massive photographs of these guns being put into great big melting pots and destroying a lot of them. Now, as you can see, that was something that Australia figured it had to do, and it broke the back of the industry. It's hard to believe that would ever happen in the United States, but that's a question for another day.
So you mentioned Resolution 1270, and you also cited it in your resolution. How did that resolution influence this one? And would you please paraphrase it for
Well, I
our
will read it.
audience?
Yep, 1270 is very short. And the reason for this coming along, the new resolution coming along 25 years later, is because I don't think it was strong enough. So it's influenced the new resolution by kind of upping the requirement for the church to make a statement against firearms as part of its peace initiatives. This is what 1270 said in the year 2000. Resolved that the church encourage in its members a thoughtful and reflective stewardship regarding the use of firearms for professional or for sports purposes, and be it resolved, the church encourages its membership to renounce the personal use of firearms for all other purposes as a response to the call to recognize the worth of all persons. So there it is, 1270. It's a pretty strong statement, but we seemed to think that nothing really had happened. And part of this resolution was to remind the church that 1270 actually existed. There'd be a lot of people in the church who weren't born back in 2000, who I think probably didn't know the existence of that. So, hence, when our new resolution reaffirms its commitment and then talks a bit about encouraging nations to go about reducing actively the number of firearms in the community, was the second stage of that particular initiative, which began back in 2000.
So it's kind of like I was talking like I was saying to Cassie, it was like kind of like if a couple of kids are arguing about a toy, just kind of removing the toy from the equation, kind of. Be
Yes, and if they
spiritual.
are arguing, take away anything that could hurt each other if the argument gets a bit more physical.
So, would you mind if we read the closing paragraph in your resolution and ask you a couple follow-up questions?
Yes, what I would want you to do, if you wouldn't mind, to read the whole resolution. Because I think the last one is simply about the study materials, but I think the nub of it is in resolution one too.
Oh, I mean the last paragraph of the support statement.
Oh, the support statement. Yes, read away. That's perfect.
So, this resolution does not seek to ban firearms, nor is it advocating that people be barred from owning a firearm. Rather, it advocates for the freedom and security for people to go about their daily lives without the fear of becoming a victim of gun violence. That is best facilitated by people calling for limits on gun proliferation and the promotion of evidence-based policies of responsible gun ownership, storage, and use. Is by these means that gun violence will be reduced. This aim is in accordance with two of our enduring principles, worth of all persons and pursuit of peace or shalom. I love that paragraph. personally.
Oh, that's very sweet. Thank you very much. The team did labor over those words carefully, and I think that is the nub of what we're trying to do.
So, what would you say to someone who opposes this resolution because their lives were saved by a civilian with a gun?
And I'm glad you raised that too, because that issue will always come up in a debate such as this. And the best way for me to respond to that is to say this, that one anecdote, albeit a good outcome, should not be the underpinning of a resolution to suggest that guns will always be the best savior in those circumstances. Let me give you an analogy. It's one that I've used before, and I think it's very effective. We have now had some 40 years or so of mandatory seatbelt wearing. I don't know what the situation is across the United States, but certainly in Australia, it's now mandatory for every person in a car to wear a seatbelt. That has saved, over the years around the world, hundreds, if not millions, of lives over the last 40 years by people having the ability not to be flung into a sharp object in a car during an accident. So seatbelts save lives. There's absolutely no doubt about that at all. But I once heard about a person who was driving his truck without wearing a seatbelt, and he had an accident, not a major accident, the result of which was the door flung open and he fell out of the car or the truck. And he looked back. At that point, the truck burst into flames, and he said, if I'd been wearing a seatbelt, I would still be in that truck and I'd now be burned to death. Therefore, I'm not ever going to wear a seatbelt, and I'm going to tell people not to wear a seatbelt. Now, the reason I use that is because it's exactly the same thing that happened in that particular illustration you just gave. It is completely and utterly silly, if I can use that word, to suggest that one person whose life has been saved as a result of not wearing a seatbelt means there should be no seatbelts being worn or no mandatory seatbelts being worn, a policy that has saved hundreds, if not millions, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of lives over the last 40 years. The story is the same with the gun. It's nice to think, yes, that particular person's life has been saved by having the availability of a citizen nearby with a gun. But for every one of those anecdotes, there'll be hundreds of thousands of other stories where people's lives have been destroyed by the presence of a gun. And I particularly think of women in violent situations at home where the gun's available. The husband or the partner has been very upset about something. He threatens with the gun and it goes off and kills her. I would be far more likely to say I'd rather have a policy of gun control than a policy that allows a person, on the basis of one anecdote, to think he can hang on to that gun in the home and save someone's life.
I agree with that, and personally, it would be really cool to know. It would be a lot, sorry, it would be a lot better to know that the person who is saving my life, probably if he has a license, knows how to use it if it were to happen again.
Well, there's always the question about how do you know whether the person walking down the street is the good guy with the gun or the bad guy with the gun? There was
True.
a comedy thing on the television here some years ago where three or four people burst into a bar and they all had a gun and everyone claimed they were the good guy. They weren't sure who to shoot. That's the situation. The people don't wear shirts that say good guy and bad guy. So the idea of actually having a good guy with a gun is just a fallacy.
Yeah. I watched a video about this girl who was having panic attacks at school because they wouldn't allow her to have her phone because she had this experience where they thought that there was an active shooter on campus and all the kids around her were trying to get her to text her mom about these things that they just wanted to say to their parents. And now she can't be away from her phone because she has to be able to contact her mother. And so she regularly has panic attacks because they want her to not have her phone in school. How would you, as a minister, comfort someone who is having these panic attacks without sounding like you're pressing an agenda?
Yeah, well, as a minister of the church, or indeed as a human being, I would direct that person to get some solid psychological assistance as a as an issue about panic attacks. But I come back to the question, which I think underpins your question, and that is, how best do we reduce school shootings? Is it to do as some commentator, idiotic commentator, I should say, some years ago said, well, we'll just give all teachers a firearm? You can imagine how a disaster that would be. Or indeed just have active shooter trials, lockdowns, and have the children practice getting under desks, etc., and throwing desks at the active shooter, or go to the heart of the problem and make sure that there are fewer firearms available in the hands of people who shouldn't have them, and indeed then have a licensing exercise that has the effect of making sure that a person who does have a firearm for a legitimate purpose has gone through all the training, etc., and doesn't have a mental illness, for example. So the idea is not so much to try and prevent the active shooter from getting away with shooting people by having lockdown type exercises, but rather get to the heart of the problem, which is the massive oversupply of firearms in society for the first place.
Well, I mean, like, how would you comfort a person who has these attacks, these panic
Well,
attacks?
that's a matter really for a professional. I don't think ministers are best equipped to ensure that people who have panic attacks are being addressed. I can assure you, I know of two families who have moved back to Australia from the United States because their children in their elementary school years were feeling unsafe about going to school. Now, that is a lament which we should be taking very, very seriously. To think that anyone has an attack about or a panic attack about going to school because of a mass shooting, one would have thought that particular issue should be addressed and not be addressed by politicians and commentators who say, well, the best way of getting rid of that particular fear is by arming teachers or arming more people, or indeed allowing students over 18 to take a firearm to school. The proliferation of firearms is the problem. That should be addressed, not the idea of trying to put kids under desks so that when an active shooter comes along, they all feel safe. But the panic attack issue is real. There's no question about that.
So, thank you for answering our questions. Before you go, we have one last question for you.
If you could have coffee or tea with anyone, alive or dead, who would it be and what would you ask them?
I was giving some thought to this. There's a lot of people I'd like to talk to, but I really would like to talk to the late Martin Luther King, to ask about what was firing up his activism. And I don't think there's any doubt at all that he knew that he'd be a martyr, but he decided that it was important for him to continue his activism and continue to espouse the things that he valued. And I'd like to hear a bit more about his motivation in doing that, how much his Christian values assisted with him in relation to that, how much his spiritual practices assisted him in relation to the activism. That would be something I'd really enjoy.
I think that would be very, very fun conversation.
An interesting one too.
So we want to thank you for being here and talking to us and answering our questions.
My pleasure, Chrissy and Marianne. I've very much enjoyed talking with you as well.
We also want to thank our listeners for being here, and we want to remind everyone to put on their full armor of God and just walk in faith. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.